have a panel presentation, set of presentations this morning about why continuous certification. Give you the opportunity after the presentations to have a question and answer session with our expert panelists, and hopefully clarify any issues that you may have with what the process is like now and what direction it's heading. So I'm Mark Malangoni from Philadelphia. I'm one of the co-moderators along with Pat Walker from Galveston, Texas, and we'll introduce each of our panelists as they come forward. So without further ado, I'm going to get started. So my topic is, how did we get where we are today? So this, just as a reminder, the certification board movement began a little more than a century ago. The first board was the American Board of Ophthalmology, and that was formed in 1916. I listed for you on this slide the dates of incorporation of all of the other surgical boards. And you can see there was a flurry of activity in the 1920s and 30s. And then it tended to drop off a bit. The youngest of the surgical boards is thoracic surgery, which was formed in 1971. And each of these boards has their own set of subspecialties, and I'm not going to get into those details. It's probably not pertinent to this. The largest of the surgical boards is actually the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology, which has about 40,000 diplomates. American Board of Surgery is the next largest with about a little more than 30,000 diplomates. And then after that, it does tend to drop off a bit. The American Board of Medical Specialties, which all of these boards work under as a confederation, began certification and began to formalize certification among the various boards when it was formed in the 1940s. And now certification is based on a defined process, and it consists of three parts: education, evaluation, and examination. And I listed for you here what some of those requirements are. For education, it's graduation from a U.S. Or approved foreign medical school, establishing completion, satisfactory completion at a ACGME accredited residency. There are various evaluation points depending upon which board we're discussing. I've listed for you here the American Board of Surgery evaluation points. And then there's an examination. And for most of the surgical boards, there are two parts to the examination. There's a written examination and an oral examination. The timing for these varies a lot among the boards. Some require certain time in practice. Others do not. Some allow you to take the written examination during your training. Others do not. So that's all quite variable. The recertification process actually began with the American Board of Family Practice, which was formed in the early 1970s. And shortly after the Family Medicine Board was formed, the American Board of Surgery began issuing time-limited certificates, which meant that you had to recertify, and that began in 1976. The other boards have followed, mainly over the next few decades, and this process includes a variety of other things besides just passing an examination, and I've listed those for you here as well. Well, the American Board of Medical Specialties and the Accreditation Council on Graduate Medical Education, the latter of which is responsible for all of the programs, the training program requirements, got together, and in 1999, under the leadership of David Narwald, who is a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and a general surgeon himself, came up with these core competencies, and I think most of you have heard these repeatedly. There are six of them. We all understand very readily patient care and medical knowledge. That's been around for a long time, as have been a number of the other competencies, but not as well defined or codified as they were with this publication that came in 1999. Well, ABMS turned these six competencies into four components of what was called maintenance of certification, or MOC. And this happened and was implemented fully in 2005. And what I wanted to point out to you with this slide is that of these four components of MOC, Three of them were already in place before anybody ever named MOC. So professionalism and professional standing has been a requirement and something that has been tracked by the American Board of Surgery since its founding in 1937. I mentioned to you the importance of recertification that came in 76, and then lifelong learning self-assessment, which is basically a CME requirement by the American Board of Surgery, was in 2000, and then the practice improvement activity in 2005 was the latest to add. So how are we doing? Okay, so there have been lots of starts and stops and questions about maintenance of certification and now continuous certification. So I would point out to you that more than 95% of the American Board of Surgery diplomates participate in MOC. And that number is very similar for all of the surgical boards. So the participation rate is extremely high. What do you have to do? It's pretty simple. You have to maintain a license. You are not required to work in a hospital or have OR privileges, so this recognizes that some surgeons do administrative tasks entirely or non-clinical tasks and do not require hospital privileges for that bit of their practice. The most common reason that we see where people do not participate in MOC is they don't get their CME done. So it's always interesting because when you hear pushback about MOC, there's always the thought that everyone does CME anyway. So why do we need to have this requirement? But we know that everyone doesn't, and that's part of the problem. And so making certain that that's assured is extremely important. You obviously have to pass the knowledge assessment, and then, again, that Part 4 requirement, participation in some sort of a practice improvement project. And for most surgeons, that's some type of registry. And whether it's one of the registries offered by the American College of Surgeons or whether it's a registry that's maintained by another professional society, all of those work. So why do we do this? I think that's the question comes up over and over again. Well, first of all, it establishes a national standard. That's extremely important. So there's no variability state to state about what's required. And clearly for medical licensure, there are quite differing requirements state to state. So having some sort of a national standard seems to be really important. It does document everyone's ongoing commitment to professionalism, lifelong learning, and quality patient care. It upholds board certification as a standard, which is extremely important, and it's defined by the surgical community. So, you know, surgeons set the standard here. It's not outside agencies setting all the standards. They provide a framework, but we are allowed to choose what goes inside of that framework. And it gives the surgical community a proactive position in all of the healthcare quality issues that go on today. This is how many people respond to MOC. We've seen this over and again, but I think that's beginning to change. And I just want to point out to you, and then we'll move on to the next speaker, some of the questions that come up about why we even go through all of this. So this is a study that was published in 2002, looked at surgeons in the Chicagoland area and began to look at what their outcomes were for segmental colon resection, depending upon whether they had board certification in surgery or colorectal surgery or not. And I will tell you that from a more detailed review of this, most of the board-certified surgeons included were general surgeons and not specifically colorectal surgeons. And what the authors found here was that certification was significantly associated with reduced mortality and morbidity. That was important. We know about the NISQIP outcomes, and this is one of the NISQIP-related articles that looked at outcomes in NISQIP hospitals over time. And you can see a dropping level of mortality, more overall morbidity, and surgical site infection the longer you participate. And while this does not necessarily measure an individual surgeon's contribution to this, we know that as a group of people practicing in a hospital, it certainly does relate, and that's important. And this is from an article published by Andrew Jones and his associates about a month ago in JAMA. that looked at the association between maintaining your certification and whether or not you lost your medical license. And that, again, due to an action taken by a state medical board, and you can see from this graph over time that if you allow your certification to lapse or if you just don't ever recertify, your chance of having a loss of licensure action, which actually puts you out of practice, is more likely than if you do recertify and continue that certification. I put this last slide up just to show you one example of a new assessment program. For those general surgeons in the audience, you may recognize that this has just been implemented this year. It's still in process in its first year. And this is the requirement for taking an assessment that is shorter than the traditional 200-question examination. It includes a list of references. Its purpose is much different. It really has an educational background to it, and we'll hear more about that by one of our later panelists. References and list of topics to be covered are provided in advance, so if people want to study to prepare for this, they can. Rather than going to a testing center, it's an internet-based open book type of evaluation which can be completed at your home. And importantly, rather than an every 10-year window for administration, this is done every 2 years. And I will tell you that among all of the 10 surgically related boards, including the American Board of Surgery, everyone is beginning to either move to a shorter assessment period or has a pilot study in process to examine whether or not that's for them. So that seems to be the direction we're heading, and it really goes along with the rapid change in knowledge that I think we've all had experience with.